Welcome back, everybody, to a post-Easter edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim Priester with Drew Mentach, both of us from Irish Illustrated. It's Dingus Day in South Bend. I don't know if or exactly how many people know about Dingus Day. They know about it in Buffalo, New York. They know about it in Cleveland and Chicago. And also South Bend, a big Polish-American celebration marking the end of Lent. So big day in South Bend for the politicians and the Polish Americans on the southwest side of South Bend. My family grew up in that area, so I'm quite familiar with it. Drew, what's your heritage? Did you celebrate Dingus Day?
A little bit. My dad didn't grow up here, but he is Polish. Mentach is actually, they changed it from a Polish last name because no one could pronounce it. So it should be Polish. It should be Mlechek, which my understanding, it's probably not accurate, but it was Milkman. So I am. And then they changed it to Mentach because I guess that's how everyone in the coal mines in Wyoming was saying it. So,
got it. Well, we are six practices into Notre Dame's 15 allotted spring practices. They'll pick it up again this week. They've had a few days off because of the Easter break. So did the media as far as our access to them. So we really haven't had anything happening since last Wednesday when we met with Marcus Freeman. But before we get into kind of resuming what has happened in spring practice and what lies ahead, I did want to mention that 24/7 Sports' Zach Blostein put a crystal ball on Zayden Gamble, a safety, a top 200 safety out of St. Thomas Aquinas High School in Fort Lauderdale. That's been a pipeline for Notre Dame over the years. So Zach is choosing Notre Dame or putting a crystal ball on Notre Dame over Miami and Florida and Ohio State, and that is noteworthy. Also noteworthy is that Notre Dame will have a couple of highly rated wide receivers visiting this weekend, one of which is Julius Jones, the son of former Notre Dame running back Julius Jones. And Blostein put a crystal ball on Oregon this past weekend because that's where Jones was. He'll be at Notre Dame this weekend, along with wide receiver Osani Gales, who is a top 50 overall prospect. He's a high school teammate of Amari Irvin, a linebacker that's already committed to Notre Dame in 2027. So a lot picking up here again, getting back into the recruiting cycle as well as spring practice. I did want to also mention that, oh, I know what it was. I took the question out because I got confirmation as to when the Shields Family Hall is supposed to open. There's a date set for August 7th. Originally, when they began the project, which was estimated at more than $100 million, Jack Shields, a former Notre Dame linebacker, is behind all of this. Originally, they said a fall date opening, but August 7th is the date. Jack Shields had promised me a personal tour of the place, and I'm going to hold him to that. I know he'll live up to that. But Drew, you know, as we get back into spring drills, nine more practices to go. We'll have an opportunity to see a little something this week,
right?
Four periods, and then next Saturday we will have the jersey scrimmage followed by the blue goal game. So what's ahead for us is considerable. We haven't had a ton up to this point other than the first opening practice. But as we look ahead to the last nine practices, what are you anticipating seeing or some of the competitions that are heating up?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious how much just exactly now that they're doing more full pad stuff, how much Aeneas Williams can actually be involved. And you mentioned we'll only get to see four periods, but just maybe hearing about that, what will be leading up to the jersey scrimmage. I know he has the red jersey on. Can he still kind of get a lot of those live reps? How is that kind of working for a running back who needs to take some physical contact? And I mean, also with the offensive line, I know Marcus Freeman said a lot of really good things about Will Black, but things are going to, you know, he's still a young guy. He's going against some of the better defensive ends in the country every day. How is he actually doing holding on to that spot as we kind of get more and more into spring ball, I think are two things that stand out. But yeah, we don't get to see a ton, but that jersey scrimmage is definitely a highlight of the spring and, you know, a week before the
spring really game. And in a lot of ways, more so than blue gold game, because you'll have units, yeah. You'll have first unit offensive line playing with one another. And it doesn't always work out that way in a blue gold game. But, you know, we get a lot of questions about competition. We'll have them in second segment about who can beat out whom And I keep turning my attention back to the receivers because that is probably the area where it's most competitive. There's 15 or 16 receivers, quote, scholarship receivers. I realize everybody's on some form of scholarship now, but the ones that were brought in on scholarship, it's extremely competitive. You have a bunch of freshmen that are in early. I know a lot of people were excited about the Devin Fitzgerald clip that Notre Dame showed of him turning his body, making a catch across his body with his backhand, and it was a spectacular catch. I don't know if Devin Fitzgerald is in the running there yet. I'm not really sure if we can say any of the early entry freshmen are in the running. There's five of them out there.
Right.
We saw some stuff from Bubba Frazier in that opening practice. But, I'm still very intrigued by Mylon Graham, where Jaden Greathouse is with his hamstring. So as I look at this, I look at that receiver room, and that's where the most competition is taking place.
Definitely. And I agree. It'll be tough for the freshmen to really climb the depth chart this early. And I think on that pass that we saw from Devin Fitzgerald, I think Noah Grubbs was the one who threw it to him, which was a nice ball from him too, but it kind of gives you a sense it's not like that was coming from CJ Carr per se in terms of where he probably is on the depth chart right now. But I agree. Mylon Graham, I mean, we heard good things early. He looks different out there when we see him, but what does it actually look like as we kind of progress through spring practice? Hopefully Jaden Greathouse is starting to play healthier. And what's a competition like for those two guys and Jordan Faison kind of in the mix over there too. We know he can move around a little bit, even though he took most of his snaps outside last year, I think almost 90%. But I agree. Until Quincy Porter gets back, I guess there'll be less real competition in the boundary. But I agree the kind of other side of the field with the receivers. There's a lot of talented guys. Elijah Burrs, too, a guy who seems like he has a better grasp of the playbook, which is what kept him off the field last year. I'm curious what that starts looking like, especially in the jersey scrimmage.
You and I are of like mind. I don't think anybody's necessarily disagreeing with this, but Jordan Faison, I know you did a feature on him and you spent more time with him. And I think we addressed that in the last podcast a little bit, but I think you and I are very bullish on Jordan Faison, the way he looks physically. He's always been a really confident kid. He wouldn't be in the position he's in if he didn't come in here with a lot of confidence and carry himself with confidence. But what makes you certain or excited about the fact that Jordan Faison, he did lead the team in receptions last year, so he's already a lead receiver, but I think he has a chance to build upon that.
Yeah, I think you look too at just his overall development. Like, he played quarterback in high school, walked onto the football team, kind of had to find his niche. I mean, I remember talking to him about that Louisville touchdown. They taught him pretty much how to learn run two routes well and kind of got that look and got him in the game. So I think just to see kind of his rapid development while he was playing lacrosse, being one of the best players on that team too, missing a lot of spring ball, I think just now that he can actually focus his craft on wide receiver, I think he still has a lot of room to grow, even for as good as he's been, just because his time was divided. And even compared to a lot of other wide receivers in the room, he's still relatively new to the position.
He developed great chemistry with CJ Carr last year, and he's in a position in the field side where, he has opportunity to catch a lot of passes, and he makes himself available, and CJ Carr recognizes that. So I think he will continue to be a high volume guy. I also, looking on the defensive side of the ball, and I think I've said earlier in previous podcasts that most of my attention is, I think they're more question marks on the offensive side of the football. But when you look at the defensive line, you've got those five defensive tackles. Gray, I include Burgess in there. He would be the fifth. Brew, Onye, Hughes, those guys are, it's a great competition there. They have more size with Teon Gray. They have more strength with Francis Brew. Really looking forward to seeing, especially as we get into the jersey scrimmage, what's happening there in the middle of the offensive and defensive lines, because that should be quite a battle.
Definitely. And I'll be curious too, because we saw that first full practice and we saw Partridge really kind of pair the defensive tackles. Like, they were always with the same groupings throughout that. And I'm curious if once we get to the jersey scrimmage, is that the type of thing that stays? And then that maybe that's a little easier to project like where they're on the depth chart and stuff like that, or are they willing to mix and match a little more? Because there are a lot of really interesting body types too. I mean, you talk about guys who are, 6'2" and strong like Brew, or guys like Teon Gray who are 6'6", He says he wants to get to 315. I'm curious if he probably feel like he's going to be more 325. But you have a wide variety of bodies that you can mix in there. I'm kind of curious what Coach Partridge wants to do in terms of his rotation by then.
Yeah, we're not. I mean, invariably, we're always talking about undersized defensive tackles for Notre Dame, and with Donovan Heinisch, unfortunately, by the way, you know, condolences to Donovan and Kurt and the Heinisch family with the passing of their father recently. That guy put up a hell of a battle. I have a ton of respect for Mr. Heinisch and everything that he went through. But you know, with Donovan injured, no longer playing, they're not undersized there at defensive tackle anymore. So the ability to mix and match there is a little bit greater.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and yeah, it's. I mean, you used to have guys like you mentioned, Heinisch, who kind of won one way, and now I feel like Notre Dame up the middle can win in a variety of different ways. That will be interesting. Plus, with what they have coming in and back, that just the bodies and what they look like at defensive end, I feel like it's going to look like a different defensive line overall, maybe than what fans are kind of had previously seen from Notre Dame up front on the defensive end.
Yeah, I'm curious the defensive end too. I mean, I think Boubacar Traore, and I really feel strongly that Bryce Young. You know, we got a question on in second half of the episode here today. You know, I mean, Bryce Young, he kept growing and growing and growing through high school, and he didn't stop growing when he got to Notre Dame. And the expectations is that he's Bryant Young's son, and he's immediately going to take off. And I don't know that that was. I mean, he was really kind of just still learning the game of football in high school, and then he kept growing, and then he got to Notre Dame, and he was impressive enough to throw him in the lineup and have him play. I just wonder if maybe our expectations were just a little bit too high for the guy under the circumstances. And now in his third year in the program, and I think, you know, he's probably, hopefully he's settled on the size and the weight that he wants to be, because he felt undersized, he put on a bunch of weight, and now he looks definitely trimmed down. But I don't know how you feel about Drew, but I think he's ready to really take off.
Yeah, and I think it definitely is a pass rusher. I'm curious how much that weight change hurts. I mean, we saw, I mean, it was Cooper Flanagan, who's a really physical guy, so not taking anything. But I think that's one of the plays from that first spring practice that really stands out, that in the run game, Cooper Flanagan was kind of able to drive him back one-on-one. So I'd be kind of curious on, I mean, that's just one rep, and Cooper Flanagan's a really good blocker, so also not the worst thing in the world. But I'm curious if maybe he sacrificed a little bit for pass rush in order, or to be a better pass rusher in order to kind of ascend that way. But also, he's probably just getting used to his body, and maybe that will make him a little better with leverage and things like that too. So I agree. I'm definitely curious to see his development in a live rep and situations like that.
Yeah. You know, we haven't heard a ton about Keon Keeley. I don't know that we've had an opportunity to necessarily talk to the right people and get the lowdown on Keon Keeley, but he's the third defensive end in the equation. And we were all pretty impressed with Rodney Dunham and Ebenezer Iwatadi in the full practice that we were able to see first time around. I wonder where that competition is, because I really suspect that Dunham is a guy that's going to be very difficult to keep off the field when it comes to the rotation at defensive end.
Definitely. And Marcus Freeman bringing him up last Wednesday when the question wasn't even about him, I feel like it's pretty significant. And he definitely flashed a ton in that first practice. I think I had him down as he would have had three sacks. Not necessarily he wasn't going against the first team, but he's just a guy who's explosive. He's kind of living up to that billing and made some good plays against the run, too. I'll be really curious in that jersey scrimmage if we get to see him going up against a Gerby Lambert or Will Black or some of these other guys we expect to probably be Notre Dame starter. What does he look like in those? Because I think he is a guy with what the rotation looks like too. It might be just too talented to keep off the field even early in the season.
We'll wrap up segment number one, Drew, with a little Final Four talk from the weekend. I don't know how much of an opportunity you had over the Easter weekend to see the competition between UConn over Illinois and Michigan over Arizona. You know, people keep doubting UConn. We need O'Malley here to insert UConn's record against the spread in postseason play in the last 4 years, because there was a lot of people picking Illinois to beat UConn. UConn was the better team. The Michigan victory over Arizona was extremely impressive, which is why, once again, UConn's going to be underestimated a little bit. Saw the line at 6.5 here with Michigan, but boy, that was a powerhouse performance by the Wolverines.
Yeah, and I watched the first half, and then I felt like it was good enough to go to bed after that. But yeah, they'll be tough to beat for sure. I think the difference between UConn and Arizona is UConn does have a lot more of that experience, where Arizona's best players, where their freshman class, I feel like, are a lot of them. So that will be a little interesting, is like, kind of, you know, if you're UConn, at least can match them. Other than Mullins, I think they're a lot more veteran guys too. And we saw how tough they are. I mean, what they did against Duke, who, you know, is a team that beat Michigan not that long ago. So I think it will probably be a better matchup than people are thinking. But Michigan is just kind of on a roll right now.
The women's Final Four, a little bit of controversy there between UConn and South Carolina. Geno Auriemma getting upset about a pregame handshake after he just got his butt kicked in the game. That seemed a little bit out of line. That's all been played out. And then UCLA ends up beating South Carolina pretty handily. I didn't know a whole lot about UCLA, but I certainly thought South Carolina was in a position to win the national title after beating UConn. Thoughts on that, Drew?
Yeah, I watched actually pretty much all those games. I mean, I was a little surprised, but I think South Carolina gave everything they had. Like, they lost. They got blown up by UConn in the tournament last year. I think they put so much into, like, we're going to find a way to beat this team that's undefeated. And they really just kind of ran out of gas. But and you got to wonder if that Geno controversy just added extra stressor to the weekend. I mean, I think Dawn Staley handled herself pretty well after that. But it took him multiple days to apologize. He's a guy who used to go after Muffet pretty hard too. I feel like the coaches that can beat him, which I think Muffet beat him five times in the NCAA tournament, he takes it pretty hard at them. And yeah, just not a great look for him. And be curious. I know he has a few years left on his deal, but I'm wondering if he's still going to be coaching for a while. He made it about him in a way that I don't think was very appropriate.
Yeah, I would agree. We'll wrap up this segment one with some more bad news from Notre Dame men's basketball. As expected, Cole Serta is expected to place his name in the transfer portal. That opens tomorrow on Tuesday. So that's a clean sweep of the top three with Harrelson, Burton, and Serta. We already had the three previous departures from the roster. We talked in the last podcast about Notre Dame needing five or six, and not just transfers, but starters, and not necessarily all five or six starting potential, but, you know, at least three starters to insert there. This is a really, really difficult situation. They're in a hole. Whether you kept Shrewsbury as a head coach or didn't, he was going to get paid either way. But whether you kept him or not, you were going to be in a really difficult situation. And look, it's not just a Shrewsbury thing. If it sounds like we've painted that picture, that's not an accurate portrayal of what the situation is. It's a team that I don't think is coached very well, that also is not funded, or a program that is not funded well. So on two fronts, Notre Dame men's basketball is in a real predicament here.
Yeah, it's all, I mean, we'll see what they do in the portal. You got to think they're going to go after maybe some diamonds in the rough, but they kind of need help everywhere at this point. So it's going to be really kind of interesting to monitor what that portal period looks like. And then after that, just what should the expectations for a program be like this year? I mean, it almost feels like you're just running out the contract for Shrewsbury, because it doesn't feel like you're going to have much hope. But he's going to really be, you mentioned some of his coaching issues, he's going to be really tested this upcoming period and what he can put together, because you have to think he knows his job is in a precarious position, like we all do. And what is he going to be able to do after losing, you know, most of the team's most talented players?
Yeah, this is why, you know, you see these, as soon as a championship is decided, you see the way too early top 25 for next year. You can't really do that anymore until you know what teams do in the transfer portal. You have no idea what kind of basketball team Notre Dame's going to have until they hit the transfer portal. Obviously, it's going to be a little bit piecemeal and putting it together, and they're not going to get some of the top-rated transfer prospects that some other schools do, but it's way too early to have a way too early listing of teams until you know exactly what's going to happen in the transfer portal, especially for Notre Dame this year. That's it, segment one. We'll be back. Segment two, burning up the boards. Segment two, burning up the boards on Irish Illustrated Insider. We start with a question from PA Irish 5. With about half of spring practice in the books and based upon what you've seen and heard thus far, which players have the most at stake in the remaining practices and jersey scrimmage?
I mean, I think we touched on a few of them already, but I think Will Black and really that whole line in the structure, because you still, if you're the left tackle, you're still a younger guy. Anthony Knapp has started there the last two seasons. If you're not going to live up to that position, they have a really obvious guy they can kind of adjust things going into the fall. But if he really cements himself now, then it really makes their plans going into the fall and what they're going to do with Anthony Knapp clear, and it kind of sets him up to really lock down that position. Nolan James, I think, even though Aeneas Williams is doing some stuff this spring, he's not as available. Nolan James, we keep hearing good things. We keep hearing about his work ethic. If that translates to the field again, he's going to set himself up really well. So I think those two are the two first guys I wrote down. I know you touched on the wide receivers earlier as well. I don't want to overanalyze spring too much because there's still a lot of time and things to do over the summer and fall camp. But I think those two guys, just in terms of where they want to place them, could be pretty significant.
I look at the tight end position and, you know, I think we see the two Flanagans, James and Cooper, and Cooper coming back from the injury. And we've probably talked ad nauseum about the importance of Cooper. And then I wrote another story after you just wrote a story about about Cooper Flanagan over the weekend. But I just think that he's that key. But my point being this, that I think that Ty Washington is a guy that needs to finish strong this spring, because I think the two Flanagans are there, the two guys that I know that Mike Denbrock likes a lot. And then you have Ian Premer coming in June, who adds a different component to the position. So when I look at guys that, you know, have a lot at stake, I think Ty Washington's playing time is at stake in competing against the Flanagans. And then the other guy I would look at would be a defensive tackle, Chris Burgess, who is the fifth guy in the rotation. We can easily slot four guys with Onye and Hughes and the two transfers. But where does Chris Burgess fit in? He's now 300 pounds. I know you had the defensive side of the ball when we had that open practice, Drew, when you did the practice report. He's a lot bigger than he was when he got here, when we were still talking about him as a defensive end. But those are two guys that I would mention.
No, I think those are both really good. And I agree with Burgess. I mean, we'll see. He can, you know, he's done a lot to change his body physically, but how does he hold up throughout a whole spring? What is his endurance and stamina look like? And I know that's a position where they heavy rotate, but we still haven't seen enough to really validate him other than just that he physically looks much bigger and is clearly committed himself to playing in the interior.
You know, the secondary might be one of the more fascinating areas to study because, well, first of all, DJ McKinney is not here, which is really unfortunate. There's three freshmen and DJ McKinney that aren't here yet. And McKinney will almost undoubtedly will play a significant role. I think I expect him to come in and take one of the starting cornerback positions, which is why they've been talking to Christian Gray about not just talking, but implementing him at nickel in competition with Dallas Golden. And so the competition there will continue to be great. And the possibilities there are great because you do have so much talent on the back end of the defense. Question two from Not Jay Tafel One. Any news or insights on how the backup quarterback battle is shaping up?
I mean, I think it's still too early. I mean, I think you hear some good things about Grubbs, but obviously Teddy Gerard isn't on campus. And I think Marcus Freeman was being probably pretty honest when he said it's way too early to make decisions or on those roles. It's, you know, six practices in, and you're seeing some really bad things and some really good things out of both of those players. So you're going to, I mean, we've seen some highlights like the one from the throw to Devin Fitzgerald, the one-handed catch. Like, you can see some of that talent in the ball jump out of Gerard or Grubbs' hand. But to be that backup center or that backup quarterback, you really need to have somebody who's reliable there, who you can trust to kind of go in a game and at least in that situation not lose it too. So there's going to be that consistency thing, and you're not going to have that a really good picture of that until much later into next fall.
It's difficult for young quarterbacks to be consistent throughout spring drills because they have different practice plans for each practice. And the point I'm getting to is when we had an opportunity to talk with Gino Guiduli a couple weeks ago, you know, we all saw the first practice for Noah Grubbs, and he agreed. I mean, he was aggressive and he threw the ball well and accurately, and so he had a good day. And then when they practiced on Saturday, you know, Grubbs wasn't happy with his performance on Saturday. When they had practice three, it was a better one. Guduli said he had a better practice, but then he noted practice four, they were going to work on third downs, and he anticipated that he would struggle with it. So that's just kind of the roller coaster of a young quarterback in these early times. And Hebert really is a young quarterback too. Guduli talked about, you know, he really wasn't, I mean, he was here in the spring last year, but he wasn't in competition with Carr and Minshew for the starting job. So he really got shortchanged during the spring. So it's an up and down battle for all these guys, but I think especially quarterbacks when the practice plan changes. And as you mentioned, Drew, Teddy Girard is coming in, and it's not a coincidence. He didn't just suddenly decide, oh, okay, I think I'll reclassify and come in early. It's something obviously the Notre Dame wanted him to do to compete with these young quarterbacks. And, you know, I really like what I see of him on film, and I think it's going to be difficult to keep him out of the number two spot just based upon pure ability. But it's way more than pure ability. It's reading defenses and understanding concepts and setting pass protections and all those things, which we anticipate Teddy Girard being able to do. But I'm sure right off the bat, it's going to be, you know, a little bit problematic for him.
Yeah, and to your point on Hebert, too, he spent all last fall as the scout team quarterback, too. So he wasn't even getting to learn a lot of those things you just referenced, because clearly Kenny Minchie was the backup in that situation, too, during the fall. So I think they're all kind of in a similar boat, and they're all going to have a lot to prove, especially once Girard gets here. Our next question is from Maltese Irish. Make a bold prediction. Tell us a player currently lower on the depth chart who will jump a player or two ahead of them before the season ends, naming who they will jump to.
Well, bold predictions on our side of the fence end up being reckless because you get called out when you're wrong in the future. You know, but this is not the makeup of this team is not such that you're going to have a lot of young guys in a position to jump anybody. It's an extremely veteran defense. And then you plugged in the defensive tackles and the defensive end from the transfer portal and some help at cornerback. So there really aren't a whole lot of opportunities, you know, realistically for a younger guy to jump an older guy. But one of the guys that we've talked about, and again, this was a podcast question last week about, you know, what number, 1 to 10, what number would you put on Matty Augustine beating out Sullivan Apsher, 1 to 10? And I think we said 2 or 3.
Right.
And yet Matty Augustine's a good football player, and they know that. And Marcus Freeman, you know, doesn't just mention the static starting offensive line and then mention Matty Augustine. He doesn't do that accidentally. They obviously like him, but that would be a name that comes to mind. I think Rodney Dunham is a guy that, you know, might be in a position to jump somebody. I don't know that Jaden Sanders beats anybody out, but if they have to turn to Jaden Sanders at cornerback, I think he's a guy that will represent himself in Notre Dame secondary pretty well.
Yeah, I kind of cheated and wrote down Dallas Golden just from the standpoint that, I mean, he was with the first team in the first practice we saw, but I think he's just too talented that he's going to maybe win the job. I don't know that he's going to completely keep a guy like DJ McKinney off the field, but if I'm going to make a bold prediction is I think he's starting early in the next fall. I think he's just too talented. Other than obviously Leonard Moore, I think he might be their most physically gifted cornerback, especially with Adams out right now too. So I think he's just got a ton of talent. He got a lot of experience. He makes plays. Like, I think he's going to see more playing time and carry a bigger role than maybe I anticipated coming into the spring.
I'll double down again on Bryce Young. Again, this isn't answering the question per se, but I'll double down on Bryce Young being a guy that really steps up. I think that he's paid his dues. I think he's a guy that's learned an awful lot here in the first couple of years, maybe more on occasion this past season, more negative than positive, whereas freshman year he's blocking kicks and things are coming a little bit more easily to him. And he was coming off the bench, you remember, when R.J. Oben was starting. So I'll double down on him. But, you know, this is a veteran football team. And so, you know, major surprises and jumping a couple guys on the depth chart, this team's preparing for a 12-0 run during the regular season. and they don't have too many open spots per se.
Our next question is from Rob Kiefer. With the surge that Will Black has had this spring, how do you feel about this offensive line going forward? Barring injuries, could this be one of the best offensive lines we've seen in the Marcus Freeman era?
You know, I'm doubtful that it reaches that kind. I mean, it's full potential without a healthy Ashton Craig and Charles Jagusa, because I think that that's how you fully maximize this offensive line. You know, Will Black's coming on, but I mean, even Marcus Freeman said last week that it will still be a bumpy road for Will Black. And we still have to see whether he can handle the really quality defensive ends off the edge. Fortunately, he doesn't have to open against Miami like Anthony Knapp in his second year had to this past year with Emil Wagner. But, the best offensive lines of the Marcus Freeman era, if they stay healthy, I mean, that's what's been so difficult to achieve, especially in 2024. It's really amazing. O'Malley has said it a couple times that, you know, 10 different guys on that offensive line at a certain point during a run to the national title, that's almost unheard of. So in order for them to have a chance to have the best offensive line under Marcus Freeman, they need to have a little bit more good fortune as far as avoiding some of the injuries that have struck the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think it's just way too early to tell. I mean, Will Black is super talented. I think in that class, I had him rated as my second best prospect. I mean, the screen pass he took in high school that he ran like 50 or 60 yards with, I mean, he just moves differently. He is kind of a freak athlete at that position, but it's everybody but Joe Otting is kind of playing a different position than they finished last fall at. Like there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of people are learning new things. So while I think they're super talented, and maybe the two with Jagusa out, the two most talented players are at left and right tackle right now, which is a good sign. I think you also just have to realize like they're all doing new things, and we don't really know what they're going to look like come the fall. And they're really not going to get maybe a real test until October too.
That's the key. I mean, you have an opportunity to have a little bit of trial and error early in the season and still survive it. The bottom line is just get a W and keep moving forward. And Notre Dame's in a position to do that, and that could allow this offensive line to grow. But, you know, again, to reach their full potential, Joe Otting did a really great job under the circumstances last year. But I think we all understand that Ashton Craig has a higher upside. And I've defended Sullivan Absher with his size and the way that he improved after his first start last year. And we had a question last week about Charles Jagusa and, you know, why are we so convinced that you know, he's all that? Well, we mentioned a couple of the variables that go along with playing quality offensive line, and he has those in addition to the size and just a savvy to play the game really well. So I think those guys allow you to fully maximize your opportunities on the offensive line. Question number 5 is from Bitter Irish. What is Marcus Freeman's biggest weakness as a head coach? What is his greatest in-game moment as a coach? For me, it was trusting Biagi for that Georgia fake punt craziness.
I mean, I think we've talked about this a few times, but they haven't always come out of the gate in the season just kind of firing on all cylinders like we want. Like, I understand last year the schedule didn't set up well for things, and you had to play your two tough opponents off the bat, but they really didn't quite understand just how much work the defense had needed at that time, how many miscues and poor communication, and they clearly had to change some things just in terms of what they were doing technique-wise. So if they had that type of thing sorted and had a better awareness of it coming out of fall camp, they probably can fix enough to beat Texas A&M when they lost by 1 point and things like that, and that changes the dynamic. And we've obviously seen some bad losses early. So I think from a negative standpoint, maybe just kind of, while I think he is well in touch with his team, maybe he doesn't quite have everything as well figured out right at the start of the season as you would like to see.
I think it's pretty astonishing the risks that Marcus Freeman has been willing to take, you know, since he became head coach. And Bitter Irish mentions the fake against Georgia Tech, and there have been many others. The fake punt against USC at USC at the end of 24 when it was fourth down at their own 25 in the first quarter. I mean, that's a risk that was completely unheard of not that long ago. You just didn't take chances like that. You just punt the football and let your defense take over. And so I have great admiration for that. He stands by what he professes, and that he wants his team to attack. And so if you're going to expect your players to play in that mode, you have to coach in that mode to a large degree as well. And he has done that. As far as the biggest weakness, yeah, game two. He's not very good at game two. And I don't know how you figure that out exactly. I think we always talk about how great he is with his messaging. His messaging between game one and game two must not be as strong as the rest of his messaging game. But, you know, I think we can clearly say that there are more positives in Marcus Freeman's corner than negatives. And he learns, you know, that's one thing about Marcus Freeman. He learns from his mistakes moving forward. And I'm sure that he'll come up with a plan to avoid that upset against Rice. That can't possibly happen. Rice can't possibly beat Notre Dame in game two in Notre Dame Stadium.
Yeah, but as we've said, it's happened before, I guess. But I think going back to the biggest in-game moment, kind of, I think the Georgia play is a good call. And I think that just kind of goes to, I mean, my wife's a big Lions fan. I think Dan Campbell maybe has had a similar mentality at times where you're entrusting your players to go out and win the game. You're saying, like, we're going to, even if it's a fake play, you're like, we want the ball in your hands. We're not going to give it back to Georgia to see if they can do something. And I think he does that throughout his career. It's we have enough confidence in you that we want to give you a chance to go out and win this. And I think that type of thing speaks really well to giving the players confidence and letting them perform.
Yeah. And then it gives the confidence to the defense as well, because you're saying, hey, okay, we'll put our defense in a bad situation. Our defense will bail us out. It's really an empowering point of view and perspective from Marcus Freeman that I think has rubbed off and worked really well with his players.
Our next question is from Smurf Turf Irish. There are four injured players whose recoveries will impact the season. Which would impact the Irish the most if he suffers a major setback? I'm not including Jagasaw. The four options are KVA, Ashton Craig, Drake Bowen, Quincy Porter, and then to a lesser extent, you could include O'Malley's guy, Madden Framo, and the starting running back who happens to have an ongoing seven-month elbow injury.
You know, I would bunch KVA and Bowen together because that's the heartbeat of Notre Dame's linebacking core. Jaden Osbury, very good, always around the football, minute per minute, one of the most productive players on the team. And Jalen Snead is a guy that continues to get better as he goes further into his time at Notre Dame. But I'd put KVA and Bowen together because that's the centerpiece of your linebacking core. Then I'd say Craig, you know, because I think Joe Otting could do a fine job at center. I just think that Ashton Craig's upside is much higher. But at least that you know if you have to turn to Joe Otting for an extended period of time, he's a guy that can play and play well. Quincy Porter, we don't really know what Notre Dame has there yet. We assume that he's, you know, somebody that will impress along the lines of the way that Mylon Graham has this spring. But you have Micah Gilbert there, and that's another one of the guys that I'm high on this year. I think Micah Gilbert, what a nice tandem, Drew. If you could have a healthy Quincy Porter and Micah Gilbert to have that tandem at the boundary receiver, which Notre Dame rarely has two guys that they could use interchangeably.
Yeah, and they do bring a little bit of different skill set too, with Porter, I think, being probably the faster of the players and the bigger one too. But I think in terms of physicality and maybe just a little bit of, like, as he put it, wiggle or quickness, you can see a lot of plays from Gilbert. But I agree, he's, because of Gilbert, it's hard to put Porter any higher than fourth. And I mean, Bowen is practicing to a degree this spring. Obviously, a setback wouldn't be great, but I don't have any right now concerns that he won't be ready to go for fall camp. So I think KVA coming back at a time that gets him back kind of mid-season. I wrote a story the other day for Irish Illustrated just on, like, if, you know, a year, if he comes back about 11, 10 and a half months after the injury, he's back for BYU. And that's huge, because I think at 100%, he's your second best defender or maybe third best player on this team. So I think he's super talented. There's so many different things that he can be used for, and in terms of just moving him all over the defense. I think he's good in coverage. He's excellent off the edge. He was Notre Dame's best run defender last year in a lot of ways. So even though he didn't start every game last year, I think having that weapon back for the toughest games of the year, which are in the second half, I think would be pretty significant if he's not back for those.
Yeah, I think maybe I should say KVA is 1 and Bowen is 1A because of what KVA can do off the edge. I mean, that's a legitimate additional pass rusher. We always talk about pass rush from the defensive ends, but when KVA is healthy coming off the edge, he's as good as anybody, you know, rushing the quarterback, including Traore. You know, he doesn't get nearly as many opportunities off the edge, of course, as Traore does. But, yeah, I think 1 and 1A there. But, you know, both those guys are really significant. I think Drake Bowen really, really came into his own last year as a leader, especially after the adversity faced at the end of the Texas A&M game. Matt Framo's a guy that they need as well. And, you know, to give them the kind of depth there that they would like. We have a question from Kay Beasley. In your last podcast, Pete Sampson proclaimed his love for Nolan James, and it got me questioning if he could emerge as a starter versus Wisconsin. If that happened, how would you compare it to recent opening game starter surprises, including Blake Fisher at left tackle versus Florida State, Anthony Knapp named starting left tackle, Luke Telich starting the 2025 game versus Miami, and Jafar Armstrong, who started against Michigan. I had a couple touchdowns against Michigan a few years ago.
So I wasn't covering the team for two of those. So it's hard for me to speak to how big of a surprise as Armstrong was, or even Blake Fisher, even though I still think of them, Anthony Knapp winning the job. I mean, that also took, I mean, we thought he was a center prospect, and that took Charles Jagasaw suffering the fall camp injury and then him being able to kind of win it out. So I still think that would be the most surprising. So I would kind of slot the Nolan James potentially starting there behind that. But I think he's a guy we've heard a lot of good things on. I don't think it would be shocking at this point, and especially given what they lost too. So while we've seen a lot of good things from Aeneas Williams 2 years ago, he's had the elbow injury. There's still a little bit of a reason why he didn't play last year. And Nolan James does all the right things. And presumably whoever the two backs are, they're going to be rotating a lot. So even if Nolan James is the starter, it doesn't mean Aeneas Williams isn't playing, for instance.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, as it usually is, from Kay Beasley. I'm not sure that I can make an exact comparison because, as you said, I mean, the running back position has become a timeshare position at Notre Dame in most places. Now, I do think, regardless who starts, I don't think it's going to be, well, for example, Jeremiah Love had 199 carries last year, and Jadarian Price had 113. I don't think the disparity between Aeneas Williams and Nolan James Jr. in terms of carries is going to be as great as that was. I think, you know, Jadarian Price is great in his own right, but Jeremiah Love is a transcendent player, skill position player for Notre Dame. So it's a little bit different. And so he had ended up having 86 more carries. There won't be 86 carries a differential between the two this year, because I think they'll be a lot more interchangeable. But as far as like surprise, I don't know. Nobody expected. We didn't think Anthony Knapp had the capabilities to play left tackle. We considered him to be an interior offensive lineman. And all of a sudden he's starting the opener in 2024, and then, you know, ended up starting 27 out of 28 games, only missing the national championship game because of the injury against Penn State in the Orange Bowl. So not an exact comparison, and you know, again, I think the point I really want to emphasize is I don't think there's going to be the disparity in carries between Aeneas Williams and Nolan James Jr.
No, I agree. Yeah, I mean, we'll see if those two both are the 1-2 running backs, and we don't see much of a rotation beyond that like we saw last year, which I think, given Sider's reputation going back to Penn State, is a real possibility. But if those are the two guys, throughout the season, I agree, I don't see the discrepancy in their carries being like was last year. Whereas for as good as Price is, I mean, Jeremiah Love might be a top 5 pick for a reason.
All right, this last question we'll wrap up with, it's actually directed toward me from System Man 167151. TP, love you and the crew, but can we put a little more respect on Kyren Williams' name? Every time the gang talks about Notre Dame's great running backs, you guys never talk about Kyren Williams. Let's show our man some love. Do we do that? I think the problem is that Jeremiah Love came along and he's the greatest running back in Notre Dame history, and you tend to fall back on that as long as he's still in the program.
I agree, and I think as we talk about NFL draft and stuff like that, it's easy to overlook Kyren Williams in terms of what he was as a prospect, because there's a reason why he fell to the fifth round. Like, I think he ran a 4.65. Like, athletically, he's just not the marvel that a guy like Jeremiah Love was. So I think maybe we don't talk about him with the reverence, but obviously the numbers speak for themselves. I mean, what he did at Notre Dame was special. He's a pro bowler in the NFL. Like, he has exceeded expectations. He got a new contract before the season or after the season started, one of the two, but he's got an extension. Like, he's doing all the right things, and he probably does deserve more praise, but he just, in terms of what he did as in his last season and just athletically, he's not quite on the same level as Jeremiah Love.
I will admit that if a Jeremiah Love hadn't come along, we would probably reference Kyren Williams a little bit more often than we have in recent months. All the ton of respect for Kyren Williams, a guy that, as you said, Drew, I mean, 4.65, a guy that's not blessed with all the abilities of some of the great running backs in the NFL, and yet he's a pro bowler and a guy that, you know, his team entrusts to hand him the football. Hard-nosed, tough-minded, believes that he can accomplish anything that he puts his mind to. Love the frame of mind and the mindset that Kyren Williams plays the game with, and I promise System Man 167151 that we'll do our best not to disrespect Kyren Williams moving forward. But, a guy that actually we were more surprised when he, during his rookie year, when he had an opportunity on a screen pass and it didn't work at Louisville, where he kind of lost his confidence and never got another shot again. I'm more surprised at that than what he was actually able to accomplish, because he was such a tough-minded guy.
Yeah, and I think some of the highlights here, I think still, I've mentioned this on a previous podcast, but my favorite long runs to have been covering Notre Dame was his, I think, 93 or 94 yards against North Carolina, where he kind of reversed fields. And I think it makes it more impressive that he isn't a burner like Jeremiah Love, that a guy like that can be that shifty and then break away from the defense. I think makes it even more fun to rewatch, knowing maybe he isn't the most gifted athletically by comparison.
All right, well, we're going to be on the Notre Dame practice field again on Wednesday, April 8th. We only get four periods. We'll have an opportunity. I'm not sure who we're talking to, because who we had scheduled originally right. Was a couple coaches and positions that we've already spoke to. So we'll find out then. We'll have an instant analysis. That'll be Drew and me. Tim O'Malley is expected back on Thursday for our podcast. And then Friday we'll have another interview opportunity. No practice access. We'll reach the final 2 weeks of spring practice coming up by the end of this week. Until then, this has been Irish Illustrated Insider.